I'm Thea Card with a check of the KDLG local news. Last week, the Dillingham City Council voted to delay on the annexation petition, and several council members' support for annexation now appear tepid at best. Annexation will not move forward until the council votes to adopt it. An adoption vote will then forward the petition along to the Local Boundary Commission, or LBC, for review. The council met last Wednesday in a special meeting in order to take that vote, but during a workshop ahead of the meeting, Councilman Keggy Tubbs voiced concern that the process was moving too fast. He said pushing the vote back would serve as an olive branch to other communities that forming a borough was still an option on the table.
I believe more strongly than ever that borough formation is in all of our best interests. And even if it's a possibility of delaying our decision, to show that good faith effort to the communities that were serious about borough formation, because our last tact did not work, was not successful. Maybe it's time to try something a little bit different.
Tubbs did say he still supported annexing the Nooshaget Commercial Fishing District, which would allow the city to resume collecting a 2.5% raw fish tax. The annexation was adopted through a vote of Dillingham voters in 2012, but was struck down this spring following a legal challenge. The council chose to resubmit essentially the same petition to the LBC, but this time through the legislative review method. That means the petition will likely end up before state lawmakers, who have to vote to not adopt it in order for it to not pass. What is not currently on the table in any shape or form is creating a new borough, though many do feel that's the end goal for the Nooshaget drainage communities. Dillingham Mayor Alice Ruby stressed that annexation and borough formation are not mutually exclusive.
I mean, we can, if we submit the petition, borough formation seems like it's, you know, on a serious path, you can pull the petition.
The problem with delay, said Ruby, is the current timeline. According to the city's lawyer, Brooks Chandler, if the petition is not submitted soon to the LBC, and if the LBC takes a full year to review it, the city's annexation of the Nooshaget Fishing District may not go up for legislative review until the 2017 session. Councilman Paul Liedberg said that the city had a clear mandate from the voters in 2012 election to move the annexation forward, and that any further delay, even of several months, is unlikely to promote any progress towards forming a borough.
This petition was passed by the council in the past. It was approved by the LBC and then ultimately approved by the voters. I think it was, if not overwhelming, it was certainly well supported by the community. So it would take a high bar to go against what the citizens and the voters told us to do the last time around.
Liedberg was the only councilman who voted against further delay. Outgoing councilman Bob Himshute, a stalwart supporter of annexation, did vote for the delay, but he explained to the council that was only so that the newly elected councilwoman Misty Savo would have the opportunity to cast a vote. Savo was officially seated at the end of Wednesday's meeting. Himshute said he felt a borough was not a realistic option, calling it a pipe dream, and is not a reason to push annexation further back.
There's nothing I've seen that shows that it's anything but a stall tactic. And by using that to put off the application for annexation isn't a way of dealing with the problem. It's a way of putting the problem off and letting someone else deal with it later.
The council will deal with it later. It is scheduled to take up the vote again at its next regular scheduled meeting on November 6th. The principal of Wasilla High School says her students are shook up after a visit with Congressman Don Young on Tuesday. Young, known for brash talk throughout his four decades in office, spoke to students about suicide and gay marriage in a way the principal describes as hurtful. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Wasilla High Principal Amy Spargo says Young spoke to about 120 students and took questions.
Congressman Young's standards are his standards, but in our school, the standards we set for kids are higher than that.
It started to go downhill, she says, after a teacher asked about Alaska's high suicide rate and framed her question by telling Young that a student at the school took his own life last week. As first reported by Alaska Dispatch News, Young said suicide shows a lack of support from friends and family. Spargo says it was insensitive.
Our students took offense to that. I took offense to that.
A spokesman for Young didn't return messages by deadline, but said in a written statement the congressman was being frank and forthright, but acknowledged he should have been more sensitive given the recent tragedy. Spargo says one student voiced his disagreement to Young, saying he'd been taught that suicide was a function of depression. Spargo says Young didn't take it well, and the discussion escalated.
The student eventually did, with emotion, say to Congressman Young that the student we lost had friends and that he had support and his family loved him.
Young later said the boy needed to learn some respect. But Spargo says she's proud of how all the students handled themselves.
We spend a lot of time talking at our school about how we treat people. And it, when somebody treats someone in a way that's disrespectful, we call foul on that. And really what our students did was they called foul on the way they were being spoken to.
16-year-old Danica Ingersoll arrived at the assembly late. She missed the exchange about suicide, but heard Congressman Young condemn gay marriage.
He made it really clear that he thought it was morally wrong and out of the question was one of the things that he kept repeating.
She also said he brought up animals, saying something like, if you put two bulls together, they don't produce a calf. That didn't go over well either, she says.
People were whispering and shuffling in their seats. It was just an uncomfortable place to be.
Classmate Reagan Johnson also missed the suicide comments, but heard Young disparage gay unions.
It was kind of abrasive, and he brought in a lot of statements that were a little hurtful to our school, I think, just because we are a safe space, and it was a little harsh.
On ADN.com, the story quickly attracted hundreds of comments. Many thought the reaction to Young's remarks was a case of political correctness run amok. Young is 81 years old and has been in office since 1973. It's not the first time his frank talks with teens has raised eyebrows. He once used a crude term for a sexual act in talking to Fairbanks students about the photography of Robert Mapplethorpe. Spargo, the principal, says some parents are questioning her judgment in allowing the congressman to speak to students.
They are thinking that I should have seen that coming, but I've had really great experiences with kids interacting with our national leaders. It's a wonderful opportunity for them to learn and see our leaders and role models in action. So I had no reason to believe that it would become a hurtful experience for them.
Young's Democratic challenger, Forrest Dunbar, agrees Young's comments were insensitive, but says he's sure the congressman is sorry he said them. Dunbar says he doesn't intend to exploit the error for political gain. In Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The National Park Service will hold 17 public hearings this fall to hear comment on proposed regulations and environmental assessment related to sport hunting in Alaska's preserves. The state of Alaska's Board of Game loosened its grip recently on predator hunting practices in many areas. However, as Assistant Regional Director of Communications for the National Park Service, John Quinley, says, the organization is seeking comment because there are some specific problems.
Deals with the what's now a relatively small number of practices allowed by state regulation for the taking of bears, wolves, and coyotes. And we have had temporary restrictions in place on some of these issues for the past 3 to 5 years, depending on the location. And these would be permanent regulations that would allow us to not have to go through the temporary process every year, which is really not what those temporary restrictions were meant for.
Quinley wants to make it very clear any regulations that would be imposed would in no way restrict federal subsistence hunting on NPS-managed lands.
This has no effect on federal Title VIII subsistence users, but is only on affecting sport hunters and preserves.
The proposals include prohibitions on taking wolves and coyote pups and adults in early summer when they den and their pelts have little commercial value, the taking of brown bears over bait stations, and the use of artificial light to take black bear cubs and sows with cubs at dens.
And then we would also change some other more procedural aspects of our notification of sport hunting restrictions, and our original regulations were from the early 1980s, and don't mention things like using websites and internet as an appropriate means of notifying people.
The last in-person public hearing is scheduled for November 20th in Naknek at the Bristol Bay Borough Assembly Chambers at 7 p.m. Last month, the U.S. Navy held public scoping meetings across coastal Alaska to get feedback on its planned training in the Gulf of Alaska. KBBI's Shady Grode Oliver attended the meeting in Homer and has this report.
There were two things on people's minds at the meeting, sonar and marine mammals.
June is probably, because it's the lightest month, is probably the most important month for the marine mammals, and that's when they're doing the testing.
Olga Vonsegaser is one of the founders of Eye of the Whale, a nonprofit research group that studies humpback whales in Prince William Sound. The group has been researching the mammals for more than 20 years. She says she's concerned about the possibility of using active sonar in critical habitat, especially during the summer, which is prime time for whales.
Like I said, they don't plan to do sonar this time, supposedly, but they are allowed to, and they're allowed to take whatever 30,000 takes. That means that there's 30,000 whales there when they let their sonar off. That means that they can affect 30,000 whales or marine mammals. So it's a lot. You know, and it's just poor timing.
The takes are outlined in the Navy's Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement, or EIS, for the Gulf of Alaska training. They refer to individual animals affected by a particular event. Conrad Erkelins is an environmental protection specialist with the Navy. He says the Navy had to request a specific number of takes to comply with the Marine Mammal Protection Act and other environmental legislation. He says Navy research shows the majority of predicted impacts to marine life are not physical.
Well, the majority of the effects that we're talking about, that we predict that we'll have, are behavioral effects, where a marine mammal, if they hear the sonar, or they are in the area where there's intensive activity because there's lots of ships around or helicopters hovering, that they will leave the area. And that's the majority of the type of thing we think we're going to see is behavioral effects that are not of extreme significance.
In the EIS, the Navy outlines the type of activities that could potentially have an effect on marine life. They include underwater explosions, simulated weapons fire, high ship and aircraft traffic, and sonar. Alex Stone is the EIS project manager. He says the Navy tries to use passive rather than active sonar as much as possible.
One of our primary mitigation measures is to use the minimum amount of sonar that's necessary. So there's certainly not the case where the Navy is indiscriminately using sonar, active sonar. When we're using it, it's because it's required to locate that submarine, which is extremely difficult to do.
Stone says the Navy understands that there's a balance between environmental protection and necessary training. And Erkelins says that's why the Navy is conducting long-term research on impacts to marine life. He says the Navy doesn't anticipate many, if any, negative effects on marine mammals due to the training, based on studies done elsewhere.
I guess the takeaway from the research that we've been doing for the last 8 years in places where Navy really intensively trains and tests is that we don't see impacts to population, like population level impacts and long-term consequences. The indications look like the marine mammals in those locations where we do things very intensively, as opposed to what's proposed for up here, the marine mammals seem to be doing fine. So
science is an ongoing process of discovery, and for these guys to say they're not going to have any problems or deaths or effects on marine mammals, they don't know that.
Shelley Gill also works with Eye of the Whale. She says the research the Navy provides in the EIS is good, but after studying whales for more than two decades with the nonprofit, she sees ever-changing results and discoveries. That's why she says she does not understand why the training needs to happen in this particular location.
Well, I mean, look at the world. There are so many degraded environmental areas. I mean, I hate to say, you know, go do it in somebody else's backyard, but why would you pick the last place there is on the planet that's got some habitat integrity, a little bit left, you know, and decide to, you know, go out and whoop it up with the war games? I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me.
The Navy states that it's important to conduct research in the Gulf of Alaska because of the environmental conditions found here. More frigid water, and different weather. Also, the Gulf's proximity to bases in Alaska belonging to other branches of the military allows for joint training, which the Navy says is essential for combat readiness. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
U.S. Senate candidate Dan Sullivan's campaign has come to Bethel. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more on the challenger to Senator Mark Begich, who, if successful, may be the senator that tilts the power balance in the Senate from Democratic to Republican.
On a clear and chilly Friday afternoon at the Alaska Territorial Guard Park, Senate candidate Dan Sullivan walks along the Wall of Honor and asks Tundi Rogers about the names of those who served.
Is that your uncle?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Stepdad's over there, and I got cousins in the Eek, Quinnahawk, Good News, Hooper Bay, down to the whole wall.
Boy,
I used to know
proud
these guys.
Tradition.
Wearing his combat boots, the lieutenant colonel in a Marine Corps Reserve unit was getting the face-to-face contact with potential voters that many say is essential to success in rural Alaska. Retail politics, of course, is one voter at a time. Buck Bukowski is wearing a button that reads Yupik for Begich.
I'm going to try and convince you to change buttons.
I don't know.
Less than 3 weeks before Election Day, Friday's visit marked Sullivan's first to the YK Delta in over a year of campaigning. The rhetoric, however, between the two campaigns has already reached a shrill pitch on rural issues. Sullivan alleges that incumbent Senator Mark Begich has been saying that he has the Native vote
locked up,
a statement that Begich spokesperson Max Crows says his boss has never made. It's ugly on both sides. The Begich campaign has positioned Sullivan as an adversary to subsistence users, tribes, and rural Alaska. Sullivan, however, is quick to defend his rural cred.
But I have very deep ties with the Alaska Native community that go much deeper than my opponents, because they're family. And my daughters are Alaska Native girls. And my wife is Alaska Native. And what we're doing is we're going around the state with a great leadership team. I am very proud to have some of the most prominent Alaska Native and rural leaders in the state, all different parts of the state, supporting the Sullivan campaign.
Begich has said repeatedly that this race will be decided in rural Alaska and has opened 16 field offices. That presence was apparent at a Bethel Chamber of Commerce lunch, where Democratic staff sat in the back and a tracker with a national group working to elect Democratic candidates videotaped Sullivan's every word, looking for a slip-up or material to be used in ads. After a stump speech focusing on low-cost energy, reducing federal overreach, improving public safety, and dealing with the salmon crisis, Sullivan heard directly from Bethel residents. In the first question, John Wallace said he was disappointed that Sullivan did not attend the Association of Village Council Presidents conference earlier this month.
Didn't get an invitation, so, you know, you kind of... But we're here, right? And we're here. I'm here. She was here at that event. For the very reason you mentioned, to get out, talk to people.
She was Sullivan's wife, Julie Fate Sullivan. Dan Sullivan planned to travel to Hooper Bay and Aniak over the weekend to shake as many hands of potential voters as possible, along with Senator Lisa Murkowski, who's endorsed him. Sharon Chakuchin attended Sullivan's lunch. She says not knowing the extent of Sullivan's involvement in the Katie John lawsuit, which the state appealed when he was attorney general, gave her pause.
We just heard that term Katie John, and it just strikes a chord in your heart. Oh my gosh, Katie John, that's terrible. So I figured we need to hear the other side of it. We have to know what that's about.
Sullivan says he was just doing his job to protect state sovereignty, but says he supports the federal rural subsistence priority. But his opponents consider the decades-long lawsuit an attack on rural and Alaska Native subsistence rights. Sullivan will come face-to-face with his record as Attorney General this week at the state's largest gathering of Native people, the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. Both campaigns are proudly listing prominent rural and Alaska Native endorsements. Sullivan planned a campaign in Aniak with former State Representative Carl Morgan.
I think that, and I know that he's going to do a lot of plus for Bruce Alaska.
Sullivan says if he's elected, he'll forge a new relationship between the region and federal government and work to bring opposing sides together to fix the subsistence system.
One of the things that I'm a big, big proponent of is sitting down with all the different stakeholders, hearing them out, and trying to get common ground to move forward. Can we do that on subsistence? I think so.
Early voting begins October 20th. Election day is November 4th. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Many of the stories you hear during the KDLG local news can be found online at www.kdlg.org. You can also find contact information on the website if you'd like to provide a comment, correction, or a news tip. That's a check of the KDLG local news. In Dillingham, I'm Thea Card reporting.